On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have Mr. Curtis Franklin and Mrs. Heather Williams back on the show. And we talk about ransomware attackers that they took on some oil pipelines recently and they gave up shop. Plus, if you listen to any other episode about Wi-Fi and the latest vulnerabilities out there, this should be the episode. We have Jim Palmer, Senior Solution Architect from Ruckus Networks on, plus our great panel of experts to take us through all the major exploits and the latest frag attack. Shouldn't miss it. Twyatt on the set.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 443, recorded May 14th, 2021. Two-headed Wi-Fi sharks. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Nareva. Getting your audio ready for meetings back in the office? Nareva Audio is designed for distancing. It automatically adapts to new room configurations so you're ready for the new normal and whatever comes next. Learn more at nareva.com/twit. And by FlexTrack, the powerful yet simple security management platform that helps you to get the real cybersecurity work done. With FlexTrack, you'll streamline your assessments, analytics, and reporting. Visit FlexTrack.com/twit and claim your free month. And by Bandwidth, a cloud-native carrier with a global network offering SIP trunking, toll-free E911 and messaging services, centralized telecom services, and successfully migrate communications to the cloud with the telecom power behind the majority of Gartner's UCaaS and CCaaS Magic Quadrant leaders. Learn more at bandwidth.com/enterprise. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world's connected. I am your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through the big giant world of the enterprise. But I can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their field, starting with our first co-host, who is an expert in wireless technology. She is Mrs. Heather Williams. It's so great to see you, Heather. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm fine. It's so nice to be back finally. I feel like I took 2020 off and haven't seen you guys in a while.
I know. It's been a long, long time. Now, you've made some changes in the professional world. Is it still super secret, or can you tell us about it?
No, I can tell you. The cat's out of the bag. Yes, I made the decision a month ago, and I have flown the coop from Ruckus and joined Tirana. And I am super excited about what it is, the kinds of things that we're going to be doing.
Fantastic, fantastic. Well, looking forward to hearing about it all. But, also we have another great co-host as well who's joined us, and he is our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. He is a senior analyst at Omdia and a survivor of the remote black hats. Curtis, how are you doing, my friend?
Doing really well, Lou. You know, we had another remote Black Hat Asia recently, but it's looking like we're going to have at least a hybrid Black Hat coming up this summer out in Las Vegas, and I'm looking forward to being there live and in person. So lots of exciting stuff coming up, starting with what I think should be a pretty darned exciting episode we've got planned for today. I can hardly wait to get into it.
I agree. Speaking of exciting, definitely had a great, exciting week in the enterprise. So we definitely should get started. Now we're going to throw you some of this week's latest hacks at you, including a oil pipeline or two. But we also have a great segment coming up after that. We're going to go to deep dive into Wi-Fi security. And our expert guest today, Jim Palmer, Senior Solution Architect from Ruckus Networks, will take us through a new vulnerability hot off that press and might affect almost every host and client out there. Plus, we'll also talk about how you and your organization maybe can protect itself. But first, like we always do, we have to go and jump into this week's news blips. Now, like something out of a movie, the concept of cyber attacking critical infrastructure and utilities has been a fear of many. Well, just this last week, hackers have given us another reason to fear the inevitable. Now, one of the nation's largest pipelines, which carries refined gasoline and jet fuel from Texas up the East Coast to New York, was forced to shut down even after being hit by ransomware in a vivid demonstration of a vulnerability of energy infrastructure to cyber attacks. Now, the operator of the system, Colonial Pipeline, said in a statement that it had shut down its 5,500 miles of pipeline, which it says carries 45% of the East Coast fuel supplies, to contain the breach. Now, earlier in the day, there were disruptions along the pipeline, but it was not clear at the time whether that was a direct result of the attack or of the company's move to halt it proactively. Now, on Saturday, like that after, like the FBI actually said, and the Energy Department and the White House delved into the details that Colonial Pipeline acknowledged that a ransomware attack had hit its corporate computer networks. Now, the shutdown of such a vital pipeline, one that has served the East Coast since the early 1960s, highlights the vulnerability of the aging infrastructure that is actually connected in some way to the internet. Yet, and even in this case, the markets actually reacted. Now, the FBI says the dark side, a group relatively new to the ransomware scene, is behind the attack. Signs point to this being a case of bungled extortion plot rather than the collective work of hackers intent on compromising America's energy grid. But DarkSide has cultivated a, quote, Robin Hood image and touts a code of conduct in which the hackers claim that they won't target hospitals, nonprofits, and notably governments. Now, in the next week or so, the administration is actually expected to issue a broad-ranging executive order intended to bolster the security of federal and private systems after two major attacks from Russia and China in recent months caught American companies and intelligence agencies by surprise. But unfortunately, as we've seen by some of the recent cyber attacks, the doors we leave open, the more people walk in and cause havoc. So it might be time that we, you know, start locking our doors.
Well, partially in response to the Colonial Pipeline attack, U.S. President Joe Biden has issued an executive order seeking to strengthen federal cybersecurity amid growing concerns about threats to national security from attacks like the one last week. The executive order spells out a series of measures for federal agencies aimed at, among other things, bolstering threat information shared between the government and private sector, ensuring better software security, and standardizing federal incident response capabilities. Now, the order only applies to federal agencies and federal contractors, but like many federal actions, it could end up having a broader ripple effect on private industry as well. The most noteworthy aspects about the executive order, according to industry experts, are its requirements for baseline security standards for software sold to the federal government, the removal of barriers to threat information sharing, and the creation of a standard federal playbook for responding to cyber incidents. The directive requires the U.S. Secretary of Commerce to work with the director of the National Institutes of Standards and Technologies, NIST, to get input on guidelines for software security from federal agencies, private companies, academic institutions, and other entities. Within 6 months, NIST will publish a set of preliminary guidelines and standards that developers supplying to the government will be required to meet. Within the next 60 days, new guidance will become available requiring federal contractors and service providers to collect and preserve data pertaining to any security incidents that impact them. Contractors will be required to share breach information that could impact government networks to not just their own government customers, but with any agency that the OMB, Department of Homeland Security, NSA, and other federal agencies deem appropriate. Of course, no executive order is perfect. Two criticisms with the executive order are that it is too prescriptive and doesn't assign any responsibility to the government itself.
The second annual virtual Black Hat Asia event saw Troy Hunt, founder of Have I Been Pwned, deliver a keynote filled with stories about his work and industry-wide challenges. Many of his stories highlighted that organizations' own poor security practices make it easy for attackers to strike. Time and again, we're seeing InfoSec incidents happen because the fruit is so low-hanging, he said about an attack on British telco firm TalkTalk, which was first attributed to Russian Islamic cyber jihadis. In reality, it was an unsophisticated attack conducted by a 17-year-old who had little experience, but caused approximately $107 million in damage in today's money. Some organizations leave databases exposed on the internet, leaking personal information its owners never knew would be online. And a common piece of security advice is to avoid suspicious-looking websites. However, businesses may act suspicious without realizing it. This includes emails that instruct customers to download and run an app from a hinky website. It's tough for people to make decisions about security posture when an official company email could potentially be a fish. Another difficulty is when companies hinder disclosure efforts by white hat security researchers. Disclosure remains a really challenging issue in this industry, he said. Doing it in a responsible fashion, which drives us toward a better security posture, this is the problem we keep having. To emphasize his point, Hunt used the example of a lock picker with a popular YouTube account who found a vulnerability in a biometric padlock that simply fell apart when a screw on the side was removed. When he contacted the company behind the lock, the researcher was told the lock was invincible to people who do not have a screwdriver. And this is why we can't have nice things.
You remember the dark side hacking group I mentioned earlier that hit the fuel pipeline? Well, I bet you thought they were an organized ransomware cyber criminal group, right? Well, instead, this past week, this crime gang announced it was closing up shop after its servers were seized and someone drained the cryptocurrency from an account that the group uses to pay its affiliates. Now, they first lost access to their public servers. The outage affected its victim shaming blog, where stolen data was published from victims who refused to pay ransom. Now, the outage also took down its payment server that supplies its distributed denial service feature, which is used to turn up the heat on victims who balk at paying them. Now, DarkSide organizers also said they were releasing decryption tools for all the companies that have been ransomed but which haven't paid yet. A quote, after that, you'll be free to communicate with whomever or wherever you want in any way you want. Now, the instructions actually read, the dark side message includes the passages apparently penned by the leader of the Rebel ransomware as a service platform. Now, this is actually pretty interesting because security experts have postulated that many of the dark side's core members are closely tied to the Rebel gang. Now, the Rebel representative said its program was introducing new restrictions on the kinds of organizations that affiliates could hold on for ransom, and that henceforth it would be forbidden to attack those in a, quote, social sector, defined as healthcare and educational institutions, and organizations in the government sector, state, and any country. I don't know about you, but I do find it interesting that a ransomware group has a code of conduct. Who knows? The next thing we may see is a code of ethics, too.
Speaking of codes of ethics, for the past couple of years, renowned technologist and researcher Bruce Schneer has been researching how societal systems can be hacked, specifically the rules of financial markets, laws, and the tax code. Schneer will discuss his AI hacker research in a keynote address on Monday at the 2021 RSA conference, which, due to the pandemic, is being held online rather than in person in San Francisco. His address is based on a recent essay he wrote for the Cyber Project and Council for the Responsible Use of AI at the Belfer Center for the Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School. The core question Schneer asks is this: what if artificial intelligence systems could hack social, economic, and political systems at the computer scale, speed, and range such that humans couldn't detect it in time and suffered from the consequences? Among other things, Schneer predicts AIs will be able to beat humans in things like capture the flag hacking contests, like those famously run at DEF CON. The real challenge, though, is he says it's not so much AIs breaking into systems, but AIs creating their own solutions. For example, he says, humans will employ AI to find loopholes in tax codes, such as major accounting firms doing so to find a new tax dodge to sell to their customers. So financial firms aren't likely to program in rules that thwart their ability to monetize AI's knowledge. Schneer admits that the concept of AIs as hackers is super speculative for now, but it's an issue that needs to be addressed. The risk is AI systems hacking other AI systems in the future and humans experiencing the fallout, he says. The key? Harnessing AIs for defense, like finding and fixing all vulnerabilities in a software program before it's ever released.
Hundreds of wireless internet service providers were inundated with calls from customers this week when the Washington Post published an article about the Emergency Broadband Benefit, or EBB, which was launched on Wednesday to help a surprisingly wide range of people hit economically by the coronavirus pandemic. It can pay $50 for every month toward the cost of your internet service, and it's available to all families who lost some income in the last year and earn less than $198,000, among others. With $3.2 billion up for grabs, the EBB is the largest federal program to help with internet bills in the three decades that Americans have been going online. The program reflects one clear lesson from COVID-19. An internet connection has become just as important to American life as electricity and water. Watching many people struggle to go to school, consult the doctor, or work online during the pandemic helped Congress realize that the high price of broadband is a root cause of America's digital divide. Okay, maybe it took Congress a few too many months to realize that, but better late than never. Lawmakers authorized the EBB in December as part of the $2 trillion coronavirus aid package, and now the FCC finally has the program up and running in every state and territory with more than 875 internet service providers, or ISPs, on the list. For Americans struggling for broadband, help is on the way.
Now, processing power just might get faster, but with much less power. Now, as TSMC charges towards 5-nanometer transistor designs and Intel struggles for those 7-nanometer, IBM, those amazing IBMers, have topped them all. They've the world's first 2-nanometer node chip. That's right. Sure, it won't come to the market for 4 years, according to IBM, and they might not be the first name that comes to mind when you think of processor design, but they are quite the power in the semiconductor world. Now, IBM claims that technology can fit 50 billion transistors on a chip the size of a fingernail. Now, no word on whether that's a pinky fingernail or a thumb, but we'll check it out nonetheless. Now, the company also claims its 2-nanometer development will improve performance by 45% at the same power or 75% less energy use at the same performance compared to a 7-nanometer processor. Now, so what does this actually mean? Well, according to IBM, it means a couple things. Quadrupling cell phone battery life, requiring users to charge the device only every 4 days, slashing the carbon footprint of data centers, which account for about 1% of the global energy use, and changing all of their servers to 2-nanometer based processors could potentially reduce the number significantly. Now, drastically speeding up a laptop functions, ranging from quicker processing and applications to assisting in language translation to faster internet access. Now, contributing to the faster object detection and reaction time in autonomous vehicles like self-driving cars. Now, for all those geeks out there, IBM achieved this by shrinking through a new manufacturing process called gate-all-around, which stacks the transistors in 3D. Now, it's an advanced FinFET 3D stacking. Now, it's pretty cool technology, if you ask me. Now, so we were actually waiting for that thing that would actually light the fire under Intel, right? Well, it wasn't Apple's ARM-based processors, but it's the promise that IBM is back in business. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, we have a really great guest and a really great segment, and we're going to take you through some Wi-Fi security and some brand new news that just came out this week. But before we do have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Nareva. Now, remote work has allowed us to work at distance, but what happens when you head back to work? Meetings and conference rooms are still a thing, but so is the hybrid workplace, right? Well, distancing can have big implications for meeting room audio and may require changes in room configurations. You need good mic coverage when people are distanced in a meeting space. We don't have to look any further. Nareva makes this all possible. Now, beamforming systems need adjustment, often by expensive technicians. Now, tabletop systems actually may require additional mics and have to be sanitized between meetings, but both may require meeting participants to actually change behavior, like sitting in predetermined spots or which direction they're facing. Now, what if there was a better way to get a clear, reliable audio and let your team act naturally and still feel safe? One analyst called Nareva Audio the first socially distanced mic system. Now, Nareva Audio is designed for distancing. That's right. Nareva uses a completely original approach to audio conferencing called microphone mist technology, and they have 4 patents on it. That's how amazing it is. Now, the HDL-300 system becomes the first microphone and speaker bar to be certified for large meeting spaces up to 15 feet by 28 feet. It fills a room with thousands of virtual microphones, and the audio automatically adapts to any room configuration. Now, you'll get true full room coverage, so people can be heard from anywhere in the room, no matter where they sit or face, and how they are distanced. That's important. Now, you don't need to bring in technicians with Nareva Audio. You can install each microphone and speaker bar on the wall by yourself, and Nareva console puts device management into your hands and on your terms. Now, adjust settings, install firmware updates, check device status, and more, all from a secure cloud-based platform. Now, Console is included with Narrative Audio System, and when you enroll your system, you'll receive an extra year of warranty absolutely free. Now, Narrative Audio products have won numerous awards out there, including the Top New Technology Award at ISC 2020 for the Narrative HDL 200 system. Now, no matter the size of your room, they have a full line of systems for small, medium, and large spaces. Now, HubSpot is a happy customer. Jimmy Ann, their principal collaboration engineer, says, "We were so impressed with the sound quality, ease of install, and ease of use of the HDL 300. It was a no-brainer for us to adopt it." To learn more how Narrative Audio is the simple and cost-effective way to let your team's distance in meetings and still act and converse naturally, visit narreva.com/twit. That's NUREVA.com/twit. And we thank Narrative for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we have quite the show segment for you. Now we're going to talk about some breaking news on some recent vulnerabilities out there, but we're also going to have a great panel and guest to take us all through it. I want to welcome to the show Mr. Jim Palmer. He's Senior Solution Architect from Ruckus Network. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Now, you know, I'm going to bring all the co-hosts back in because we have a lot to discuss about Wi-Fi and some of the recent news and vulnerabilities out there. Now, Jim, I know there is a ton to talk about here, but I'd like to pretend for just a moment. Actually, I don't have to really pretend that I'm a newbie here in Wi-Fi. You know, we've heard about some of the recent Wi-Fi vulnerabilities out there, like WPA3 vulnerabilities. Can you maybe take us through what those vulnerabilities are, and then we'll actually get through some of the new ones and maybe how people are securing themselves from those things?
Sure. I'm actually going to go a little bit farther back on you, and sure, we'll go back to October 2017 when Crack first came out. Way back then. Crack actually was from the same researcher that brought us Dragonblood and then the new attacks that were released this week called Frag Attacks. And what Crack was an attack against the WPA2 handshake, the four-way handshake that happens when a device joins a secure wireless network. And what they figured out was there was a way that you could, if you interjected at the right time, you could get the key exchange process to restart, and they could then influence the way that key was exchanged and the encryption that was built. And hackers could then get access to that key. And once you have the keys, you know, you have the keys to the castle, then the encryption's dead. So that was a really, really big thing back in 2017. And so that was fixed. It was a, you know, sky is falling type of thing. And then in, was it April of 2019 is when Dragonblood came out? And that was an attack against the way that the encryption worked in WPA3. And the fact that they said, oh, WPA3 is doing a lot of cool encryption stuff, but if you didn't use a long enough password, then you could still crack that. And so that's kind of the history of where we've gone through until we've gotten up to this week with the Frag attacks.
Now, originally when you were talking about the previous one, the Crack attacks and the Dragonbloods, those were correctable by actually just patching the APs and so on, right?
I think it was AP patching, and it was more of changing how the process worked when the keys were exchanged. Whereas this one is, you know, and Dragonblood was actually more of, hey, we're going to change the way the standard reads and the way it explains how WPA3 is used. And the Wi-Fi Alliance and IEEE has come out recently and said, hey, you know, you can, WPA3 is fine as long as you use a long enough key and you use group 15 to 21 or something like that. And so that was fixed in the standard. This is a little different, which I think is a very unique approach to the Wi-Fi attacks on this one. So it makes it a much more interesting conversation and also a lot more technical.
Right. Okay. Well, I think then that leads us into this, because I'm super interested to figure out what's going on. What's this new thing coming up? Can you maybe take us through some of the latest breaking news here? And then I'd love to have the co-host come in and throw some questions and throw some comments out.
Yeah. So what happened was on Tuesday, this past Tuesday, Maddie Van Hoof from New York University, Abu Dhabi, released a report, and it was called Frag Attacks. And you can go find it. The website's actually fragattacks.com. And from there, you can go find the research paper and stuff like that. And what they've discovered over a lot of time is that there's ways in which Wi-Fi breaks down data that it sends, and it aggregate, you know, fragments the data, sends it in smaller frames over the air, and then devices will receive it. Now, these devices can be the AP or the station, you know, laptops, tablets, phones, what have you. And they'll store this waiting for the rest of the data to come in before they then aggregate it back together and then do whatever it is they're going to do with it, either ship it upstream for the AP or, you know, play a video on your phone, you know, whatever video you wanted to watch. And so what they figured out is there's things that we kind of assumed as Wi-Fi professionals were actually happening. Whereas like, oh, of course I would tell my AP to, you know, behave one way. And we assumed that was what was happening. And then what they discovered was that it's not happening like that at all. And we all just kind of went, oh no, this is bad. And we just never thought to look, to be honest with you.
Right. Now, the interesting thing here is, you know, obviously this attack's a little different, right? Because it's a little bit more complex than the last ones, correct?
Correct. And I think part of it's because it's not attacking the encryption. And so, it sounds funny to say that, hey, you know, this is a more complex attack because we're not attacking the encryption. But it really gets into the really, really down and dirty, nitty-gritty details about how Wi-Fi works and how the data frames and other frames associated with Wi-Fi are transmitted through the air, and how the way the physics works with how those frames get there. Because as we've gotten more and more advanced, the big selling point with Wi-Fi is faster speeds. We always want to go faster. One of the ways we get that is by using what's called multipath, in which we'll take signals and we'll bounce them, and we'll send, you know, some to the left and some to the right, and bounce them off the walls, and they come back to the receiving device, and they get there just slightly different times. And so the receiving device is like, oh, I expect to get these things out of order. And so I'll just hold it, and I'll hold these things that come in fragmented, that come in out of order, and I'll just hold it until we get everything. And by doing that, we can achieve greater speeds. But what they've discovered is the really the heart and the back end process of how this all works, there are some flaws that have existed for as long as Wi-Fi's been around, really, since 1997. And so while it sounds interesting to say, it's because it's not an attack against the cryptography and the encryption itself, it makes it even more challenging to understand.
So I have a question about that, Jim, as you knew I would.
So yeah.
I'd like to go back and sort of summarize the three attacks that you've mentioned, and you can let me know if I've got this right or not. And then I have a follow up question. So with the crack attacks that came out in 2017, as most of us in the Wi-Fi industry know, the world lost its ever loving mind over this. And I think I'm going to go out on a limb and say, I mean, this hit mainstream media. I mean, like when I say that lost their ever-loving mind, I mean, my mother called and asked if she needed to turn her Wi-Fi off. Like it's that dangerous. And I'm assuming that this is because, as you said, it was an attack against the very encryption, the WPA2, which was assumed to be at the time was the gold standard for encryption. And because it was an attack against the encryption, everybody immediately went to, identity theft and, you know, grand scales of grifting and things like that. The next attack that you described, which I think was announced in 2019, Dragon Blood, was actually, I thought, a lot worse. Because it was an attack against the brand new encryption, WPA3, which was supposed to be the gold standard for like heading into quantum cryptography and things like that. And it was Dragon Blood ended up being a combination of implementation flaws and a little bit of a little bit of hubris on the backside of the actual design of the Dragonfly protocol. And not a lot of people paid it, or not as many people paid attention to it. I think that there was, I honestly think there was some effort to keep it kind of quiet. And I'm going to come back later and ask you, but is it fixed? Is it really? But we'll talk about that in a second. And then the third one is this frag attacks that has been announced, and some people have been working on it for months, as I know you have been, trying to get your head wrapped around it and figuring out what it's doing and how it's a problem. And I actually think this one is even scarier because it attacks, as you said, at the 802.11 protocol level. I mean, so we're not worrying about everything that's layered on top. We're actually going like down and into the fundamental way that Wi-Fi works. And you said that's why people are having trouble understanding it as much, because let's face it, everybody thinks Wi-Fi is magic anyway. I mean, it doesn't work. It just happens, you know, organically. And I think that that's one of the reasons why there hasn't been as much brouhaha. I think some of it may be because how much brouhaha do we have left over after 2020? And we gave it all up over the pipeline thing over the weekend. So one, is the summary correct? And then two, why do you think that there's going to be a lot more attention being paid to this as people can get their heads wrapped around it?
So I think you're spot on in your summary. WPA2, you know, when crack came out, so crack was in 2017, WPA2 came out in 2004. So WPA2 had been around for, you know, 13 years. And we all just thought that, you know, you cannot attack WPA2. And so when they came out and they said, oh yeah, by the way, we can attack it. And not only can we attack it, we can actually, you know, attack that encryption while it happens in the air. And so I think that was a really big shock to the system, if you will. With Dragonblood, I think you also are right in the fact that it was the new one. So it was scary that it was new, but also even today, and the report talks about this, even today, WPA3 is not widely deployed and widely used in a lot of places. And so because it was an attack against something that was new that we didn't really know and understand, and also wasn't widely implemented, we just kind of went, well, whatever, you know, they'll fix it before we get around to using it. And so it's not a big deal. And, you know, with frag attacks, I mean, I'll point to the first part of the show. You know, there was two stories about the Colonial Pipeline. Anytime, you know, there's something that happens that involves technology and your pocketbook and people, you know, allegedly using trash bags to hold gasoline and gasoline shortages, that's going to just jump right up to the top of everybody's attention. And you're going to go, this is where I'm going to focus my attention on. Not some really strange way of attacking something I don't really understand. But I think the other thing that really kind of comes into it is the fact that this isn't a smash and grab type information technology, IT technology attack. You know, ransomware is very quick. It happens, you get encrypted, you get big screens, says, hey, send the Bitcoin here. But this attack really kind of plays to the long game of, we're going to put some time and effort from an attack standpoint to try to compromise your data. But it, with, you know, phishing and vishing and all the other ways to socially engineer your way into a network, trying to do some of these attacks just kind of feels like it's a whole lot of work. It takes a whole lot of time. And the end result is nothing more than what you could get with a phishing email. So I think that's kind of why it's going to take longer for people to really wrap their head around it and understand it. And while, you know, current events this week have really kind of drawn attention away from it, but in the future, we might, you know, 2-3 weeks from now, somebody might go, wait a second, you know, this one attack, this one CVE 26139, which literally punched me in the gut when I read it, I was like, holy Moses, this is bad. And I think it's going to take weeks for people to understand exactly how bad 26139 really is.
When we come back, we have quite more to talk about here. We have a lot more to talk about the frag attack and a lot more to talk about some Wi-Fi security. But before we do, we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's PlexTrack, the security management platform that brings you better reports, deeper assessments, and more insights. Now, do you spend hours and hours reporting security issues and feel like it's really getting you nowhere? Maybe you're buried in data, but still can't get a full picture of your security posture to prioritize remediation efforts? Well, we've got the solution for you. That's right. FlexTrack empowers continuous assessment, automated workflow, and effective collaboration between teams to help cybersecurity professionals do more in less time. Now, create assessment reports in half the time and centralize your remediation efforts across all scans, assessments, and audits through powerful risk visualizations, scanner and ticketing integrations, and enhanced analytics to effectively communicate risks in real time. Now, whether you're red or blue, there is a FlexTrack for every security professional to save time and get the right work done. In fact, red teams can actually import findings from numerous vulnerability scanners. They can also include screenshots and videos with auto formatting. They can create customized templates and export to Word with one click. And in fact, streamline the report writing process to deliver better reports faster. Now, the blue team can actually customize internal and external assessment questionnaires. They can also synchronize findings with task management tools like Jira Cloud. They can assign findings to team members and track status over time, plus provide attestation of security posture with robust analytics. On April 12th, FlexTrack announced they've closed a $10 million round to fuel growth of their cybersecurity workflow platform. Venture firms Nora Mosley Partners and Madrona Venture Group led the round with participation from Stage.O Ventures. FlexTrack will use the funds to continue building the team and growing the platform. FlexTrack improves the entire security engagement lifecycle by making it easy to generate security reports, deliver them securely, and track the issues to completion straight from the platform. Book a demo today. Try FlexTrack free for 1 month and see how it can change your life as a security professional. Simply go to FlexTrack.com/twit and claim your free month. That's FlexTrack.com/TWIT. And we thank FlexTrack for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we've been talking with Jim Palmer. He's a senior solution architect at Ruckus Networks. And we've been talking a lot about this latest vulnerability in Wi-Fi. I do want to bring my co-host back in, though, as well, and throw it over to Curtis.
Thanks, Lou. Jim, we're going to talk about specifics some more in just a couple minutes, but I would like to take a step way back, because you talked earlier in the show about the fact that this and many of these vulnerabilities really stem from the engineers who developed the standards reaching an understanding of how everything was working that was at best incomplete. And the gift that most security researchers have is the ability to ask the question, what would happen if, and then go ahead and do it. Is one of the long-term answers to vulnerabilities like this to bring more of that, we're going to call it hacker mindset, to the engineering profession so that, the engineers are taught from an early age not to just stop when they reach their solution, but to sort of fiddle around the edges to answer those what would happen if questions a little more consciously in the dev process.
That's a very interesting thought. And as I've kind of read the report and gone over it and thought about all the implications this has, I've really gone back and forth on this. And I think part of it stems from the idea that Wi-Fi in and of itself is such a complex technology, and it's also built on the idea that it's super, super robust, and we want that, and we like that. And as a Wi-Fi engineer, as a Wi-Fi person, my mentality is to build. My mentality is to make stuff work, and then I move on and I try to make other things work. So my brain's just not wired to think the way that some of these quote unquote hackers are, or security researchers. So while I think it's a good idea that we need to think about that, I think the better solution is for some of the different industries to start working together a little bit more. I mean, if we think about what Wi-Fi was, just 15 years ago, it was really sort of this geeky, nerdy thing that only certain people had. And nowadays, you know, Wi-Fi is looked at as a almost as a utility, as a requirement to have. You know, you go into a building, you expect the lights to be on, you expect, you know, there to be running water, and you expect there to be Wi-Fi. And so I think the solution is not to get somebody who already specializes in Wi-Fi to also now start specializing in security researchers or hacking, but I think we need to do a better job of working together, you know, Wi-Fi engineers, Wi-Fi industries with security researchers, with InfoSec people, you know, the blue teamers, the red. I mean, we need to work together because it's now turning into this ubiquitous thing where Wi-Fi is almost now the standard in some areas where they'll build a brand new building and they won't put wired ports, you know, anywhere in the office spaces. It's all Wi-Fi. And I think we need to do a better job of working together with the people whose minds do think about, let's break it apart, let's take it down and figure out what did they not think of? What did they not forget? You know, what did they forget to secure in the process of building this?
So, Jim, I have sort of a follow-up, but a little bit of a segue also, because one, I want to take you a little bit off the hot seat with that, because I know that in looking at the way engineers were going through this white paper, this research paper over the last several months, and trying to figure out what it did, what it didn't do, and whether, you know, their particular widgets were vulnerable. One of the things that I ran across with in talking to people on the engineering side is that they were just looking at it at its surface, you know, exactly the nature of the attack, but they weren't stopping and thinking, what is the hacker thinking? What is he going to do with that? And so they weren't taking it to the next level of what's my goal? What do I want to get out of this? Because there were, I think it goes back to the CVE that was the gut punch for you, because if you look at it from a hacker's point of view, there are some things that jump out at you right away that go, oh, I could do this with it, that people on the engineering team that didn't have that mindset or weren't thinking about it from a DevSecOps point of view didn't quite have. But so that's going to be my observation. I'm going to use that to segue into the question about, it's not just, you know, mainstream media that hasn't picked this up. The reactions from the Wi-Fi world, from the vendor side, compared to crack, where everybody lost their ever loving mind, and some vendors were slower to react and hadn't seen it as a big, that it was going to be a big deal. They were just going to deal with it in their patch schedule as normal. But then there were some vendors, Mojo stands out. It's now been bought by Arista. They met the announcement from minute one with a series of videos where they broke it all down and explained it to you and explained, you know, where it could be bad and the kinds of things that you could do to mitigate crack from the very beginning. Fast forward to this week, and they don't even have a blog or a security response from that. We're seeing other vendors, and by the way, you have, on your personal blog, I think, have the single best, most measured response in breaking out and analyzing and explaining what's going on with this. But from just the Wi-Fi vendor world in general, it seems to have been sort of a limp response.
You know, and I think it really comes back to how complicated and how difficult this is, because like you said, some of the engineers, some of the people working on the patches to all this stuff, because they didn't really comprehend how this could be used in the wild. I mean, I still think even today at this moment that the security researchers looked at some of these problems with one mindset. The people building the APs looked at it from a second mindset. And people like me who spent a lot of time sort of out there in the wild, out there in the field doing this stuff, we actually looked at it from a third perspective. And so we would each look at a page in the report or a specific vulnerability, and we would see it from three different ways. And so I think that's where it kind of comes from, is because there's not a clear and concise even understanding of what all of these CVEs are, because there's 12 CVEs in total in this report. So it's not just like it's a single thing. There's actually 12 different CVEs, and they all kind of group into three or four different categories. But I still think that there are a lot of engineers who don't understand how some of these things kind of mesh with what happens in the real world. And I still think that even the researchers themselves don't even quite understand some of the things that they found, just because they don't look at them from the mindset that I would, of having spent so many years, you know, building networks, running networks, and dealing with that in the wild. And so I think that's where you get these really different responses, is because even within companies, even within our company, there were questions and going back and forth about, well, what does this really, what does the CVE really mean? Is it something we need to care about? Is it something we don't? You know, how do we do all this stuff? And then it even gets even crazier when you think about the fact that because it goes back for so long, I mean, back to 802.11 A, B, G, you know, all the way through N, A, C, A, X. You know, you now start looking at, oh, we have to test a lot of different things and figure out which one's vulnerable, which one's not, how do we patch it? And I think it's almost so much of, we saw a massive element or elephant and we didn't know how to take that first bite. And so everybody just kind of went, maybe we don't take the bite. Maybe we just kind of keep going with what we got and we'll just kind of throw it out there in the wild. And I think some vendors got away with it because of the Colonial Pipeline, and they would go, oh, we don't really have to have a big response because somebody else stole our thunder.
So that's interesting, because what it says to me is that it's possible, especially if vulnerabilities haven't been addressed. And you, as you pointed out earlier, this affects not just enterprise grade, you know, the vendor AP equipment. It affects any device that uses Wi-Fi. So that includes all of the gazillions of IoT devices. In particular, some security cameras are vulnerable, and that's sort of concerning. So it means that while it may not be getting a lot of attention right now, over the next period of time, even into years, this could be something that comes back to bite people on the butt.
Most definitely. And what makes it even more interesting to me is when you start thinking about the fact that, like, I use my cell phone sometimes when I used to go out into the world, I would use my cell phone as a hotspot. So my cell phone can be a Wi-Fi client, and it can also be a Wi-Fi AP, which means now, depending on the behavior and how I've asked my phone to operate at that particular moment, I could be vulnerable to an attack against APs, or I could be in a vulnerable against attack against the client device itself. And so now, even just with one single device, you now have the possibility of not just 12 CVEs, you could have 24. How does that one CVE affect the AP and the client? And if you have a device that can do both, depending on which way you configure it, now all of a sudden you have one device that you have to test against 24. You have to test 24 times. And so, how many different...
In the interest of full disclosure, Jim and I used to work together on the same team, so we're used to stepping on each other all the time. What I wanted to do is take this back to some comments that we made earlier about the Dragon Blood, which did get some attention. It was kind of kept sort of on the a little bit quieter, but in that briefing that Matt Ivanov gave at Black Hat USA 2019, he said that this... I mean, because it's a vulnerability and some actually design flaws in WPA3 that had just come out and wasn't even being widely implemented yet. He said it's we're not sure yet how they're going to address it. Like, are they going to have to do, because it's in a design flaw, is there going to be a WPA 3.1? Well, so what the Wi-Fi Alliance has done is they kind of sort of fixed the Dragon Blood. They kind of sort of addressed everything. What they did was they went back and said, okay, here's some things that you have to do in order to mitigate for Dragon Blood, but it's not a new certification, meaning anybody's widget that is Wi-Fi WPA3 certified before the Dragon Blood fix came out, that was, I think they're calling it December 2020. 2019. It's been a while. whenever that fix came out, if you were certified beforehand, you don't have to go back and recertify. So there's no way for Joe Schmo, there's no way for a Wi-Fi professional to, very good way, to figure out whether that you're, that widget is using the fixed version of WPA3 or the let's just keep our fingers crossed that nothing bad happens version of WPA3. And a lot of it, the fixes are still optional even. So the question is, are we waiting for, you know, dragon blood to come back and bite somebody on the butt going forward? Because it looks like this one's going to have legs.
You know, and it's really hard to say because, you know, another thing that I like to point that I was talking to somebody about just the other day was the idea that a lot of our experiences and a lot of our work happens when we see things in the wild. You know, there's a lot of things that we do with Wi-Fi. I mean, you can look here above my head and I have, you know, just a string of APs up there and I can test a lot of things here in my office. But when I get it out into the wild, yeah, there we go. Yeah, I have a lot of radios. When you get things out into the wild, they kind of take on a different leg. You know, they take on different legs and they kind of take on a different form. But something that's happened over the past, you know, 16 to 18 months with COVID is our inability to go out into the wild and to see things, you know, and this also ties into Wi-Fi 6 because everybody's like, well, is Wi-Fi 6 really that good? And it's like, well, Wi-Fi 6 was designed for large groups of people. And guess what COVID did to large groups of people? So with this one, it's the same thing of when you're all sitting in your house, you know, it's hard to really grasp and understand what's happening because we're not seeing this in the wild. We're not seeing this in a bigger picture, a bigger setting where we have hundreds of people, where you can have an attacker that comes and sits in the middle and tries to make this stuff work. You know, when you're social distancing, it's kind of easy to spot the guy with the Wi-Fi cactus, you know, come strolling through. I mean, because it's easy to see. So it's hard to say, really. I mean, I'd like to think that you know, Dragon Ball has been taken care of, but again, without really knowing, without being able to throw it out there in the wild and see it and test it and verify, we do kind of have to have, you know, a little bit of faith that, hey, everybody's doing what they're supposed to do.
So what you're saying is once it's safe to go back into the water, we have dragon blood waiting for us?
We have dragon blood and, you know, frag attacks waiting for us. So it's not just a, you know, we have a two-headed shark, not just a one-headed shark.
A hammerhead.
Fantastic. Well, when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about two-headed sharks. But before we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Bandwidth. Now, Bandwidth provides communication services built for innovative enterprises. That's right. SIP and emergency services infused with the power of software create smoother migrations and more innovation-ready platforms for your cloud future. Now, centralized SIP with a cloud-native carrier with years of organic growth, mergers, and acquisitions have resulted in a complex tapestry of legacy infrastructure, which only makes getting to these new cloud platforms more complicated. Well, centralizing SIP with a trusted partner is a critical first step. Now, Bandwidth's software-driven approach to SIP empowers enterprises with an unmatched level of control and visibility, which includes a lot of things. Listen to this. Triggered or scheduled porting, real-time number ordering and provisioning, as well as call control features such as failover, call forwarding, and real-time reroutes. Now, in fact, you can even solve for E911 needs. Capturing precise location information at call time is critical for your organization, but converting to PRI lines and centralizing SIP can put an organization in jeopardy with accessing accurate location information and maintaining compliance with emergency regulations. Now, manage evolving regulatory requirements. In fact, multiple offices and nomadic workers with Bandwidth's emergency systems built for the modern mobile workforce. Now, protect your enterprise and your employees with precise location information and easily add or change address information on Dime. Now, access a variety of options, including both static and advanced or dynamic E911 options. Now, work with a network operator who is just easier to do business with. Now, everyone says they have great support, but they show it through their 98% CSAT score and consistent SLA attainment by their support teams. And with Bandwidth's unmatched industry support, every customer receives, listen to this, named implementation specialists to usher you through a tailored migration plan, a dedicated team of porting experts so you have a easy migration experience, plus a dedicated support personnel and industry experts to manage needs as you scale over time, 24/7 network monitoring assurance by their in-house network operations center, and clear, always available escalation paths and customer-driven prioritization of support tickets. Zoom, Genesys, and RingCentral all use Bandwidth. Now, Duet for Microsoft Teams is for those enterprises contemplating migrating their telecom to Microsoft Teams. Now, it's the only comprehensive solution for direct routing and Microsoft-certified E911, now available direct from a carrier. Simplify your Teams migration and save an average of 40% compared to Microsoft calling plans. As the telecom behind the majority of Gartner's UCaaS and CCaaS Magic Quadrant leaders, Bandwidth is best positioned to help your enterprise centralize telecom services and successfully migrate communications to these cloud platforms. Learn more at bandwidth.com/enterprise. That's bandwidth.com/enterprise. And we thank Bandwidth for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we've been talking with Jim Palmer all about two-headed sharks, but I do want to bring in back in Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis.
Thanks, Lou. Jim, one of the things that you and Mo were talking about are the number of organizations out there that were almost certainly aware of the earlier attacks, the precursor to the frag attack, but never for one reason or another patched them. And this is another case where the industry has done at least a fairly solid job of putting together a response before it was publicly disclosed. But with those unpatched, both access points and servers out there, are there any lessons that organizations need to draw for their vulnerability management because of frag attack and its siblings?
You know, it's something that I've talked a lot about recently, and again, it's kind of an interesting thing because we can go back to the Colonial Pipeline. You know, there's always this one little thing that happens that gets you, your network in problems and gets you into trouble and stuff like that. So while, especially with frag attack, what's interesting about this is the only fix for it is to patch. But there are other ways of doing it. You know, there's other ways of sort of helping to mitigate this attack to where even if you don't get a patch this week, or if you don't get a patch next week, or maybe you don't get a patch at all because your device is just that old, there are other things that can be done to sort of help out. And so it's more of a call to a bigger picture about security in general, because there are things that can be done, and the researchers point to it in their paper, saying, "Hey, there's actually standards that exist today that would, if implemented, would reduce the effectiveness of some of these attacks." And so, it's a matter of doing a better job as an organization to pay attention to some of these of all of these different vulnerabilities, of not just Wi-Fi, but trying to protect against ransomware and phishing and vishing. And so it's more about, we can do certain little things here and there, but it's a bigger security picture and, of altogether of getting a security posture for not just an enterprise, but even personal, people at their houses, of coming up with an idea that, hey, we need to pay attention to security. We need to pay attention to locking these things down so that if there is a vulnerability that's discovered, but it requires you to stand on one leg and stick your right hand up in the air, then, you're not going to get subjected to it. And it's not going to become a problem because you're doing other things to protect against that exact thing lining up to make you vulnerable.
Well, the difficulty of exploiting a vulnerability is often a very good protection against them. But you also have some things on the flip side, to look at another set of vulnerabilities that were in the press an awful lot a couple of years ago. It's the speculative execution vulnerabilities that hit Intel architectures so hard, were devilishly difficult to exploit, but they had everyone running around with their hair on fire. And one of the big problems was that the patch that was put forward to deal with them had the unfortunate side effect of just whacking the daylights out of the performance of the processors. Now, I know a lot of people are going to be asking, as they look at vulnerability management, is that true here? Because obviously the fragmentation, you talked about multipath, this was put in place in order to boost the performance of Wi-Fi. So does fixing the problem mean that we're having to take a major step back from the kind of performance we've gotten used to?
So, you know, it's funny because I was talking to some engineers and I told them, I said, you know, the fact of the matter is we are going to see a hit to performance. It's not going to be the big hit that you talked about. It's not going to whack it really hard. And part of it is because there's already this disparity in the Wi-Fi marketing, especially marketing. And I won't break out that soapbox, but you know, there's the published speed reports that we always see that, you know, we can do 1.21 gigawatt or gigabits per second, you know, and everybody's like, oh yeah. But in Wi-Fi, you never get that because there's a lot of overhead in Wi-Fi that keeps you from obtaining that, you know, theoretical maximum. And so for us as a Wi-Fi professional, we go, yeah, there's going to be a hit. But the fact of the matter is it's not going to be as big a hit as you might think. And more importantly, end users probably aren't going to realize it because most mobile devices don't use, you know, 1 to 2 gigabits per second over there. They just don't do it. And so there'll be a hit. And because we're now going to have to be like, hey, we're going to take a step back a little bit and say, if you send a fragmented, you know, frame and then something happened to your connection, we're going to just dump all that data and make it start all over again. I don't know if that's exactly what's going to happen, but if that happens, it's going to slow it down a little bit. But it'd be like saying, hey, I'm going to drive 150 miles an hour down the Autobahn, or I'm going to drive 148 miles an hour down the Autobahn. So while your speedometer will be able to tell you, oh, you're now going slower because you fixed this one problem, do you really care that you're only going 2 miles an hour slower on the Autobahn? Probably not. But it's a balancing act between security and speed, ease of access, secure. I mean, there's Wi-Fi is all about balancing, and this is just another one of those balancing acts that we're going to have to do.
Well, Jim, fantastic, fantastic ending. Unfortunately, all things come to an end. You know, we're running a little bit low on time, but I did want to give you a chance to tell the folks at home where they can find your blog, pretty amazing blog, and a little bit about Ruckus Networks.
So I do a blog. It's at jimswirelessworld.wordpress.com. And I do just a lot of wireless stuff. I started as a radio guy 30 years ago doing two-way radios. And so my blog is more about how, as I learn about networking and apply some of my radio stuff is where the blog came from. And you can find me on Twitter at WirelessJimP. And if you're lucky enough, you can, I do some Wi-Fi stuff for Ruckus every once in a while, which is nice because they keep paying me for it. So you can find me there. And I guess my title is Senior Solutions Architect. I don't really know exactly. I just call myself a Wi-Fi guy. So that's where you can find me. And Curtis, I actually hope to be at Black Hat this year as well, running the network. So maybe we can catch up there.
Fantastic.
I will look forward to it. It will be a great chance for me to exercise my expense account a little bit, and we can catch up. Talk radio.
Oh, no. Sounds fun.
Fantastic. Thanks, Jim, so much for being here. Appreciate it. Well, folks, you've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe, so definitely tune your podcaster to Twyatt. But I do want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host, starting with our very own Mrs. Heather Williams. Heather, what's going on for you in the coming week, and where can people find you and all your work?
Well, I usually say you can find me at on Twitter for Mo Better Wi-Fi, because I usually go there for a snark every once in a while. However, I have rejoined the world of the startup. And so I have this, there's this myth out there of, it's called free time and weekends. I don't really know what those are anymore, but I'm really super excited to have joined Torana. This is a we're if COVID has taught us nothing else, it's that we have to have a connectivity. Internet connectivity is just not an option anymore. And it doesn't do you any good to have fast internet to over there if over there isn't where you have to be sitting to get your work done. And it doesn't do you any good if it's not affordable. And so one of the things that we're hoping to do is bring fast, affordable internet access to everyone who never thought they were going to be able to have that. And we're going to do it, make it look easy. So if I do my job and help them do what they can do, we're going to change the world.
Looking forward to that. Thank you, Mo. Appreciate you being here and looking forward to all of that as well. Well, folks, we also have to thank Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, what's going on for you in the coming weeks and where can people find you?
Well, first of all, fast, affordable internet, sign me up. I'm ready. As for me, I'm just doing a bunch of research, talking to a lot of people, having a good time going out and researching things. You know, one of the interesting differences between doing the work of an analyst and doing the work of a journalist is that I don't write as frequently. The projects tend to be bigger. But I still love hearing from people. So if the folks out who are listening in the Twilight Riot have things that they're interested in, things that they want to know more about, please drop me a direct message there at KG4GWA on Twitter. Would love to hear from you.
Thank you, Curtis. Well, folks, we also have to thank you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to watch and get your enterprise goodness. And we want to make it easy for you to get your enterprise in IT news. So go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twiat. There you'll find all of our amazing back episodes, all the notes of the show, co-host information, guest information, and, of course, links to the stories that we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos of your choice, so you get those helpful download and subscribe links. That's right. Support the show by getting your audio version, video version of your choice and listening on any one of your devices. Because you know what? We're on all those podcast applications out there. So definitely check them out and subscribe. Now, you may have heard also, we have a pretty amazing new thing, Club Twit. That's right. It's a member-only ad-free podcast service with a bonus Twit Plus feed. Plus, if you join the club for $7 a month, you'll also get exclusive access to the members-only Discord channel. We have some amazing guests and people in there, and we have some really cool discussions in there. So I really appreciate everyone being in there. Definitely join Club Twit and be part of the movement. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit to get started today. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your friends, your family members, and your coworkers with the gift of Twiat. We talk about some fun tech topics on the show here, and I can guarantee if you share it with them, they will find it fun and interesting as well. Now, if you already subscribed and you are available on Fridays at 1:30 p.m. Pacific time, we do this show live, live.twit.tv. There's the streams there right now. We do it live. Come see how the pizza's made. Come see the behind the scenes, all the fun stuff and the banter that we have during the show. Definitely come check it out and be part of the live show. But if you want to be part of this live show, we also have a live IRC channel as well. And you can chat with the guests and the co-hosts and the Twit staff. Everyone's there. Some great characters all over the years there. Chickenhead, Ruby Mike, Chumley, Loquacious, Eric Duckman. Everyone's in there. So definitely get in there and be part of the show. Now, listen, if you can't be part of the live show and you can't be part of the back channels, that's okay. Because you know what? We still have an amazing community out there. Go to twit.community. That's a great website to check out. All the hosts are out there. We talk about the shows and tech topics. It's a 24/7 discussion place for you to post your stuff. Go check it out. Be part of the community 24/7. Remember, you can always follow me on twitter.com/LouMM. I promise I talk about some pretty amazing and interesting tech topics out there, enterprise tech topics. But of course, I also have some great discussions with people like you. And of course, sometimes I post a little bit about my day job out there as well at Microsoft to talk about the latest and greatest ways for you to customize your office experience to make it more productive for you. So definitely check out Office Scripts because that's our next greatest way to do that. But before I sign out, I do want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support This Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week. We can do this show without them. So thank you for all their support over the years. And also, I want to thank all the engineers and staff at TWIP. But of course, I also want to thank Mr. Brian Chee. He's not only our co-hosts normally, but he's also our tireless producer. And he's been in the back channels in all of the different chat rooms that we have in the back channels. He's been supporting us during the show. And of course, he also does all the plannings and the bookings for the show. So thank you, Chiebert, for all your support over the years. We couldn't do the show without you. Now, before we sign out, we also have to thank Mr. Victor. He is our editor. He's going to make us look good, sometimes we fall over our words, and he makes us all better. Thank you, Victor, for all your support. And of course, our TD for today, Mr. Burke. Burke, how are you doing, my friend? And how's the TWIT studio treating you?
It's pretty good. Just fixing stuff. Try not to break some more stuff.
That's always good.
Day in, definitely day don't out. Break stuff.
That's excellent. Excellent. Well, thanks, Burke, for being here. Thank you for supporting us. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep twiet.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? I am Ant Pruitt, and I want to tell you about my show, Hands-On Photography, here on TWIT TV. Each and every week, Thursday that is, I like to sit down and share with you the best tips and tricks that are going to help make you a better photographer. And it's not always about Photoshop. It's not always about just having the biggest and baddest and bestest camera. It can be the simplest of things, like leave your eye open when you're looking through the viewfinder. All of these simple tips can really help step your photography game up. So subscribe to the show today. That's twit.tv/hop. And I look forward to talking to you soon.